Throw a bunch of app developers and software designers in a room, give them some laptops and energy drinks, and wait 24 hours. And you could be impressed with what they come up with. So-called hackfests like these have resulted in some amazing and even profitable web tools, browser plugins, and smartphone applications. But the Circumvention Tools Hackfest in New York this past summer had a different aim: creating technologies for people living in repressive environments to take control of information on the web. Becky Kazansky attended the event. In the first in a series of episodes we're calling Drone Humanitarianism, Harnessing Technology to Remotely Solve and Prevent Crisis, she files this report for Radio Berkman.
Imagine a conference room filled with app makers, software designers, and web developers, clacking away at their keyboards, fueled by energy drinks, trying to beat each other out to birth the most worthwhile web tool possible. This is a hackfest. There have been hackfests for music, for journalism, libraries, gaming, virtually anything you could engage with on the web. For technologists trying to advance human rights and freedom of expression through open source software, the greatest wins come through collaboration. That's what a recent hackfest in New York aimed to encourage. The Circumvention Tools Hackfest, organized by the New America Foundation's Open Internet Tools Project this past July, aimed to advance what are called circumvention technologies, tools that help give control of information back to users in repressive environments where freedom of expression is restricted and online communications are blocked or monitored. Circumvention tools have been around for a while, but to give you an idea of why they're becoming such a big deal now, you only need to hear three words: the Arab Spring. As social movements have come together to tackle repressive regimes in Northern Africa and the Middle East, safe and secure access to the internet has played a critical, even life-saving role. A grassroots-led Declaration of Internet Freedom put forth five principles to guide planning around internet freedom: expression, access, openness, innovation, and privacy. When those principles aren't in place, circumvention tools are your go-to option for getting access. Some of the earliest circumvention tools available were simple proxy servers. Proxy servers allow you to tunnel, so to speak, through another computer to access content blocked in your country. But they don't do much in the way of security or anonymity. AccessNow technology director Gustav Bjorksten explains.
For some people, it's enough just to get around the block and to get the information they want to get to. For other people, that's not enough. They need to also keep their identity secret. And so that's another whole level of circumvention.
Sometimes these tools can be the only way through which journalists, dissidents, and activists are able to get information out of countries such as Iran and Syria. And much energy is put on developing solutions for other usual suspects, such as China, the Central Asian region, and Mexico. James Vasile, the head of the Open Internet Tools Project and lead organizer of the event, explained that the need for these tools is pretty universal.
There isn't a person in the world who doesn't have privacy concerns. And the work I do is focused on some people who have the most acute privacy concerns. And a lot of those people aren't in the United States. A lot of those people are activists in countries where their work is extremely disfavored, where speech rights are not as enforced as they are in America. But even in America, there are speech restrictions. There are surveillance apparatus that have been placed by your employer, for example, or by government to collect information on what you are doing on the internet and who you're talking to.
Studies by Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, released in 2009 and 2011, estimated that only about 2% of filtered users in surveyed countries used circumvention tools. Researchers project that with work to make tools more accessible, that number could be brought up to about 10% of the users most at risk. On the first day of the Hackfest, a nonprofit worker came to the event to discuss online safety for students in a Central Asian country. The organization, which is based in the U.S., encourages development of leadership skills and community building. Because of travel restrictions, much of the work happens over the internet. Figuring out how to communicate safely with the students is a huge priority. The representative asked me to obscure their voice and leave them anonymous.
The governments in this region are scared right now about youth activism, and they've taken a lot of measures to monitor and control the activities and the movement of youth. That's certainly spurred by the events of the Arab Spring, and it's likely to continue. The students we work with are certainly aware that the internet is highly censored and monitored. What they're not aware of is how it's done. And so they can be very naive about the techniques the government uses to monitor their communications. For example, a student may know that if they use the email server mail.ru, that sometimes when they send emails to folks in the West, that those emails will disappear and not arrive, or that they'll arrive in an edited form. They know that happens. They're aware of the fact that that happens, but they don't know why, and they don't know how to overcome it. So we believe that making sure they have the information they need to make those choices themselves is the most important thing.
The nonprofit worker tells me that when the organization discusses circumvention tools with students, they do it with exceeding discretion. They don't even discuss a powerful group of tools that employ cryptography, which would scramble communications to keep third parties from eavesdropping on conversations. The problem is that when a user encrypts their data, it leaves a trace.
We have to weigh out the risks and the benefits. If the information is so sensitive that it's worth the risk of being perceived as hiding something, then we will try and find a way to teach the students how to use it.
Nadim Kobesi participated in the Hackfest to work on his encrypted chat tool, CryptoCat. CryptoCat takes on the complex challenge of encrypting communications entirely in the browser, which, unlike other currently available chat programs, wouldn't require the user to download anything off of the internet.
I'm researching on whether it's possible to productively implement cryptography functions in web browsers. You can have applications in browsers like encrypted instant messaging, maybe even things like encrypted Google Docs, you know, in the future, so that all those people sharing all their data into the cloud can do so without endangering the privacy of all that data.
Nadim's background inspired his current work on tools for freedom of expression. Throughout his 18 years of life in Lebanon, he experienced pervasive monitoring and oppression. 3 years ago, he emigrated to Montreal.
I grew up inevitably having a sense of politics because that's how every kid grows up in Lebanon. I mean, we had four civil conflicts, two wars. One of them lasted 15 years, and we were invaded by three countries at the same time. So because of that, everything is monitored in Lebanon. The phone lines, the internet. There isn't a single means of electronic communication in Lebanon that is not completely monitored. I've never tried to work on encryption while in Lebanon. The government will threaten researchers with violence to not develop encryption software to be used by the masses, with the reason that if you're doing so well, then you're destabilizing the country.
Though Nadim's political consciousness has been a major source of inspiration, he's quick to point to another source of inspiration, his love for the retro computer aesthetic.
I really think that things like Game Gears and Game Boys and, you know, certain types of music, you know, Commodore 64. I mean, I know that my first reason was kind of a very serious reason, but that other reason is also really serious to me.
The project's mascot is a cute, pixelated cat, and the chat platform features a simple design. Nadim wants to see circumvention tools as more attractive and user-friendly, not just wonky workarounds for existing technologies.
I believe that usability and accessibility are just as important to achieving security, than, you know, other properties like the strength of the cryptography and things like that.
And many in the human rights space agree on the importance of this. Monitored and surveilled users can't benefit from cryptography if it's difficult to set up or requires privileges they might not have access to on a shared computer. But cryptography researchers and hackers had previously raised concern over security flaws in CryptoCat. And that discussion reached a fever pitch after journalist Quinn Norton published a profile of Nadim and his work on accessible encryption on Wired magazine's Danger Room blog, titled, "This Cute Chat Could Save Your Life and Help Overthrow Your Government." Privacy researcher Christopher Segoyan reacted to the media attention on the project with harsh words for irresponsible journalists who hype unproven tools. And experts and researchers on Twitter questioned, Is it okay to deploy things with relatively imperfect security if the ease of use, the usability Nadim gives so much attention to, means that more people could take advantage of it? More simply, is some form of protection always better than none? For many of those who weighed in and heeded 140-character clips, the predominant answer was no. Within the day, Nadim announced that CryptoCat 2 would be a browser plugin, something users would need to install. This debate brought important ethical concerns about circumvention and security tools to the fore. Who does the responsibility of safe, effective use of circumvention tools ultimately rest upon? At the Hackfest, organizer James Vasile suggested one guiding principle for tool builders.
Ethical standards for providing tools start with the intention to improve situations rather than to degrade them. So the ethical baseline, I think, for us as tool makers is to try to test our tools and know whether they are useful and when they are useful and when they absolutely should not be used, and to be honest about that with other people.
While Nadim was working on the fledgling CryptoCat, developers from Access Now were coding an extension for the Tor anonymizing network that could provide users with encryption directly at the point of internet access. Tor is one of the more well-known and widely used tools to anonymize an internet connection. Developed originally by the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory and rebuilt since then by a uniquely robust open-source community, Tor works by routing a user's traffic through multiple other computers volunteered by the Tor network members. Since users that are part of the network don't know where the traffic is going, they can't knowingly compromise the security of others. Gustav Bjorksten explains.
Access has worked pretty hard to increase the size of the Tor network. For a while now, we have been developing a version of Tor that will run on very small devices. So these devices are the typical domestic routers that everyone uses in their homes to access the internet and provide wireless networking in their home. And the intention here really is to make crypto easy for the user, where they can plug in the device and from that moment on they're going through the Tor network. The thing about a situation where keeping your identity secret is required is that if you slip up even once, the consequences can be really severe.
In places where user data is closely monitored, Tor is no longer enough. Governments can see your traffic footprint and block your connection if they see that you're using the anonymizing service. Nathan Freitas of the Guardian Project describes the state of play.
Because Tor has been such a successful and known tool, that there's a lot of firewalls and software products specifically targeting blocking Tor, fingerprinting Tor traffic, stopping. So Tor is a feature that was released and developed recently called obfuscating proxy, which just means make Tor look like something else. And you can have different plugins to that to make it look like different things. And one of those is Skype. So the Skype Morph project is takes the traffic fingerprint of Skype and then inserts Tor inside of it. It's an unending, you know, quest towards arms race, as everyone always calls it. And now that it's moved to even, you know, not whether your encryption works, but do they know you're using it?
And arms race is indeed one way to call it. Whack-a-mole or cat-and-mouse game also describe the incremental war between those making tools to circumvent censorship and monitoring and those who seek to exert control over information. Ray Short, chief of party of the Information Security Coalition, explained how the game plays out in China.
In the case of China, they have the Great Chinese Firewall, if you will, where they are blocking a vast majority of independent media sites. And then there's somebody out there who comes up with a proxy server that people can use to circumvent that. And so all these users now discover this proxy service or this proxy site, and they begin to use it until the Chinese discover it or discover the service and either block it or find a way to block that service. And then the next day they find another service, another way to work it. And it goes back and forth and back and forth. That's more of a teeter-totter example, but it is really in many ways a cat-and-mouse game, because there are people developing technology today that are to circumvent this censorship or to circumvent this surveillance. And yet, the second those are deployed, the authorities who are deploying these Narfius type of approaches will just find another way to get around it.
But the battle continues nonetheless, and Ray and the Information Security Coalition are committed to staying the course.
Where there are tools that are out there but need additional development, or there's tools that may require what's called peer review, where they are evaluated openly, that's something that we're looking to fund and we try to facilitate, and that's one of the reasons why we're here today.
For Nathan Freitas and the Guardian Project, peer review comes through collaboration.
We've increasingly been trying to partner or collaborate with other app developers or mobile developers or tool developers who see the world as we do and who share the effort, their efforts, the progress of their work in as open of a manner as we do.
On the subway to Columbia University on the third day of the Hackfest, Nathan got an idea for a coalition of secure messaging projects, tentatively titled Always Secure Messaging, or AWSOME for short.
I think what AWSOME represents is peer review. Through our collaboration, we're sharing code, reviewing code, asking questions. You have to have fun with these things, but it's a quick way to say, does it live up to our basic expectations of a tool that can be used by someone in a high-risk environment?
Along with developer collaborations, toolmakers are making an effort to work with the end users earlier on in the design process.
The more we can do to reduce the distance from the people at risk to the tool makers and get the feedback loop smaller and allowing users to drive and guide these tools, the better. Our tool with the video recording tool, essentially we have a bunch of journalists and people that train journalists around the world. They wrote the specification of what this thing should be. They wrote the narrative. It's their vision. They've never built an app or a tool before. But we can do that. We can help them learn how to do that. But they're the ones running the show and telling us what to build. And it's working quite well because they've kind of figured out what a secure mobile reporter tool should be.
The very existence of this podcast is made possible by a belief that sharing information will only make these projects stronger. But sharing information openly in this space is still far from the standard. We will never hear about most of the tools being built. They just won't be discussed openly, for better or worse. And for the tools we use every day, most of us won't know their inner workings, even if we want to. And that means that software can contain what's called a backdoor, an entry point companies can use to subvert the software or more easily gain access to data if the need were to arise. Ray Short explains.
If it's a proprietary closed piece of software, you have to assume there isn't one based upon the distributor of that software. So, for example, if Google comes out with a communicating piece of software, such as Google Talk, do we trust Google? Well, perhaps we do. Their mantra is do no evil. They seem to be sort of philanthropic in nature at times, but we don't know for sure.
Oftentimes, consumers trust products by default. Something happens, though, when the risks are demonstrated in a way that strikes home.
When I give trainings and all, I have a sort of a happy nature, and yet I talk about these really serious things, and I often give examples of how people have been arrested and in some cases tortured over these things. And I do just enough to get the audience paranoid, just a little bit paranoid. Often I'll say things, and this is very much the case, wherein if you have a mobile phone these days, if you have it where the battery's in, but the phone's actually turned off, the microphone can still be activated. You know, the GPS function can still be used. And when you use just those kind of examples, just like that, you notice the audience sort of squirm and like grab in their pocket to see if their battery is in. It's those kind of things you need to do to wake up people to, you know, what the real concerns are of these people in these countries.
With all the challenges and all the energy expenditure to get tiny wins, how do you plan down the line? According to Ray Short,
it's all incremental. I mean, I don't know. You have to take the Cold War, I guess, as an example. The Cold War was all incremental until one day the other opponent got exhausted. And I think, you know, it's going to be a case of two steps forward, one step back. Sort of like the Civil Rights Movement was two steps forward, one step back, you know, and it wasn't a linear trajectory as we like to think it is. And I think that'll be the case with information freedom. But It's going to be much more difficult to keep that genie in the bottle, if you will, to use another analogy, if parts of populations of these developing countries get a taste of the what is available as far as independent information and ready access to it. At least that's my belief.
The greatest weapon for the toolmakers in this battle is a belief that staying the course, that all of these small wins will get tallied as victories in a war that's really about peace.
There was a time where I was forced to understand two very different perspectives on how the world works. And that was a very important part of making me understand how important the internet is, because I believe that the internet can be used to communicate different perspectives on different political issues, and that is a very important part to achieving, I mean, I know it sounds cheesy, but world peace, really.
For Radio Berkman, I'm Becky Kosansky.
Thanks to Becky Kosansky for filing this report. This episode was produced by Francis Harlow and me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You can follow our continuing series called Drone Humanitarianism by visiting us on the web at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman or following us on Twitter at Radio Berkman.